Before I get started with this week's show, I wanted to make sure that I give a huge shout out to Jeannie Colwin Coaching. Jeannie is a stress and mind-body coach based in Los Angeles. She spent over 16 years battling fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and many other TMS symptoms that left her both physically and mentally depleted. After healing herself completely, Jeannie is now obsessed with getting her clients fast results through a one-on-one coaching program, which includes weekly support, consistency, and accountability. Maybe you've done therapy for years, or perhaps you've been working in your childhood or past traumas and now you want a different approach. It's probably time to take action with a results-driven approach instead, one that specifically focuses on TMS and mind-body healing. Working with Jeannie in and itself lowers stress because she'll take the overwhelm out of this mountain of TMS info and customize a simple game plan that works best for you and your current lifestyle. I like to think of it as like a filtration system. There is so much information. If you go to Google and you type in TMS or tension myositis syndrome or TMS coach or things like that, there's a mountain of information that can be really overwhelming. So Jeannie is sort of like the filtration system for you. And it can be scary to reach out for support. I get it. But hey, I've known Jeannie for years, and now her clients are achieving much more than just reducing their TMS symptoms. She's a coach that's dedicated to helping you thrive in all areas of your life. Go to her website, jeanniecolwin.com. That's JeannieKulwin.com, and book a free 45-minute discovery call to see if it's a good fit. June 22nd, 2023. Thank you for being here. My name is Eddie Lindenstein, and I'm the host of the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I want to make sure that I thank the patrons of the show. If you're interested in supporting this podcast, a great way to do it, to help pay some of the monthly publishing fees for equipment, time, energy, all things like that. Make sure you go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Let me start with Barb, Arnie, Sarah, Brian, Julie, Ross, Christina, Mike, Michael, Tony, Kelly, Irina, Mindy, Jason, John, Dominic, Elise, Emily, Daniel, Deborah, Julie, Jeff, Albert, Lauren, and Teresa. Thank you all so much for continuing to support this podcast every single week. Honestly, means the world. And I will say it until I'm blue in the face, that it helps keep this thing on the air and to do for free and worth doing for free. So it's nice to have you all here. Got an interview today. Very excited to share this with you. Now, I was looking through the TMS Wiki a couple of months ago and came across Dr. Roger Geetson, who is a neurologist and currently doing some humanitarian work in Haiti, which is awesome. We talk a little bit about that. But how did he get into this line of work? How did he find Sarno and things like that? This is a really great story. Runs about 45 minutes or so. And I'm excited for you to hear the next couple of weeks of programming. There is a holiday in the United States coming up in a couple of weeks. And so not really sure where things will fit in, but let's just say that one of the really well-known TMS doctors is being interviewed tomorrow morning. As for when that will air, not quite sure. Could be, I'm guessing it'll be after the 4th of July, but we will see. But for today, this is Dr. Roger Geetson, and I thank you so much for listening. Welcome back to the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein. And on the line with me, I'm very excited. I was trying to recall, I think this is the first neurologist that I've had on the call. I've had MDs from different walks of medicine, but it's kind of cool to be able to get this. And I found Dr. Roger from the TMS Wiki, and I'm excited to have you on. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing really good. Thanks for having me, Eddie.
Hey, and when we connected, you were on a whole different part of the planet. Where are you as we talk today?
I'm back in the United States now.
Okay.
But it was Haiti when you called me.
That's awesome. What do you do? What do you do down in Haiti? Give us a little bit of background on that, because I was reading about that project a little bit. I think that's awesome, but talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, to be honest with you, it's a major passion of mine. So I do a humanitarian project in Haiti, and the goal is to bring something of value to the people that utilizes local resources, and that if it's helpful for them, that they can multiply and spread it without being dependent on foreign aid or my organization to continue the activity. And so that was my kind of main criteria when I was exploring different ideas, and what's turned out to really be the project that's gotten the most enthusiasm from the local Haitians is an agroforestry project that it's called regenerative agroforestry or syntropic agroforestry. And I've learned it from some experts in Brazil, and we're in the process of creating an educational training center where we go around different parts of the country, train Haitians that want to learn this technique, which we've adapted to their culture and the tools they have. And I love it. We basically are just planting trees in gardens and then coming back every 6 months and checking on them and making sure everybody who's interested is getting the resources and the knowledge they need to develop this skill, which is really a highly technical skill that allows them to improve yields, have disease and drought resistant gardens and farms, and be free of needing to purchase fertilizers and things like that, pesticides.
Were you doing this project? Because the earthquake was in 2010, 2009, 2010. When was that?
2010, and I hadn't started going to Haiti until 2015.
Okay. How was it? Because one of the things that struck me when I went, speaking of natural disasters, I went to New Orleans, and I was close to the Lower Ninth Ward. This was in 2014, and parts of that looked like Katrina was 2 weeks ago, and they were 9 years removed from that. Is that similar to how it looked in parts of Haiti where you were, or how's the recovery effort been in that span of time?
Yeah, Haiti is like a continual disaster, and it's unfortunate to say that. Even outside of the many hurricanes and earthquakes, they just had an earthquake today and people died much smaller than the one in 2010. But those events, I think, are helpful in the sense that it draws some attention, they get some resources, but it's life is a crisis there every day.
Wow.
It's hard to imagine the degree of poverty. I mean, think of like the worst you've seen in maybe Central America or big cities you've been to, and just imagine like pretty much that's how it is throughout the whole population. There's like nobody to go to who's better off than you. And then you're understanding the situation in Haiti, which has deteriorated precipitously over the last 4 years to the point that other missionaries and humanitarian workers say they've never seen anything like this.
Wow. Yeah, I spent a little bit of time in Belize and then more so in Guatemala. And yes, the level of poverty was unlike anything I'd ever seen, and at least in Guatemala it was.
Yeah. Guatemala would be pretty similar, although still much better than the way it is in Haiti.
Well, switching gears, pivoting again, very great to talk to somebody who has a background in this stuff from a medical doctor perspective. I've been on your website. It's entirely about, I mean, it seems like you've more or less dedicated your life from here on out to mind-body work. And so there tends to, the medical doctors or professionals that I have on this show, a lot of times, you know, they didn't get into the particular discipline that they're in. Like that wasn't the plan initially. Something pivoted, something happened, and something changed to where they said, hey, this mind-body work or Sarno work or TMS specific work is where I want to spend my attention and my time. What's kind of your background a little bit on that?
Yeah, so I think, to be honest, I still practice conventional neurology. Mm-hmm. And I'm relying on it for my income. But I have pursued kind of an alternative career in neurology that affords me some free time so I can also do the holistic and the mind, body, spirit work. And what I do in neurology is inpatient neurology. It's called neurohospitalist. And I'm doing it right now. You're like sort of always on call. You got to stay within like 20 minutes of the hospital. So you lose some freedom, but actually you only have to be in the hospital if there's a patient that needs to be seen, once work is done, I have space and time to talk to other people.
Yeah.
And lately I do the holistic calls in the evening time. And I haven't really advertised my work, because I like to have a small, I like to keep the work small and personal. And I usually have, I don't know, a couple people every week that I'm actively working with, either new or following up. And I didn't even get to your question yet.
Yeah, that's okay.
But that gives you a better picture of, you know, what I do. And I don't have a systemized approach for this. So each time somebody calls, I mean, I have a general way I work, but I might recommend different things to different people. And my goal is to provide resources that people can use on their own. They don't become dependent on me. It's the same principle I use in Haiti. But I do hope that over time I can have more of, my goal is eventually to have more of a systemized approach as I learn from people what they need, so that they can stay engaged and know they're making progress, whether they're talking to me or not. And yeah, so to your question, how did I get into this? I think was kind of your question.
Yeah
so I have to say, ever since I started medicine, I was very interested in holistic medicine. I almost chose to go to an osteopathic or DO school in Michigan because that is their focus. And then in medical school, I was still attracted and did like a rotation where I was able to leave. I was in Wayne State Medical School, and in your senior year, I went and traveled to Arizona and worked with, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm spacing on his name right now. He's one of the big alternative medicine doctors who first got hospitals and the educational system to accept alternative practices. It'll come to me in a little bit. You got Dr. Weil, Andrew Weil, the big great.
Oh yeah, yeah, he's the breath guy, right?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, he has a lot of things, and what I've known him best for is like kind of normalizing alternative medicine in the conventional medicine world. And so this is kind of the neurologist I was when I started training and then went into practice in 2005. And I think that helps understand where I was coming from. And then I saw a lot of pain patients. So I started to, I trained to do epidural injections under fluoroscopy guidance. So I was putting needles in people's spines and giving steroid and anesthetic medicines to try to offer more than just physical therapy and meds and stuff like that. I thought it was like, you know, real value. And it was valuable, not because it worked great.
Yeah.
I mean, it does. It may work as good as placebo, you know. Some people feel great and other people so. But what it really helped me see was all the inconsistencies in medicine, because if you're going to put medicine at a particular point, you expect the symptoms in the imaging to match. And what I found is that it a lot of times didn't. And so then I don't know, do I inject where it looks bad on the MRI? Or do I inject where their symptoms are worse? And so it put me in this quandary, and you go walk out of a room for one person who has almost normal or mild changes on their MRI, and you're telling them, oh, it's this bulging disc. And then I go see, there are a couple of old guys I saw in their like 90s who had some of the worst like bone on bone degenerative disease in their lumbar spine I'd ever seen. And they were seeing me for balance problems and leg weakness, which probably was related to their spine, but no pain.
Yeah.
You know? And I'd ask them, well, when did your back get better? And you're like, doc, I've never had a bad back. And then, you know, you just feel like you don't know what's really going on. So this is kind of, and in my own, on my own, I started to tell people that, you know, we don't know exactly what's causing all the pain. And I've seen people's bulging disc gets better, and I've seen people's pain get better without having surgery. And then I had one lady come to me one day and said, oh, you sound just like Dr. Sarno, you know? And she's like, you should read. And I was like, who's that? And she's like, you have to read one of his books. And I finally got around to it. I promised her I'd read it. And I saw there was this parallel way of thinking, and he had taken it many more steps down the path. and kind of gave me more direction and confidence in what I was telling people. And that's a big part of what created my change. I also, as you probably read on my website, that I had an unexpected spiritual experience about 4 years into practicing medicine. After achieving all of my goals and realizing I wasn't really happy in life, I guess you could say there was sort of my direction started to go inward, and I started studying some different spiritual texts, starting with Eckhart Tolle and The Power Now.
Yeah.
Led me down kind of a rabbit hole, which led me into actually a very valuable place. And I had a direct experience where I could see I was more than just my body. I'll just leave it like as that. And I was aware of like an energetic presence, and that presence, when I was harmonized with it, was creating positive things in my surroundings and affecting people around me in a good way. And that only lent more credence to what I had learned from Sarno's work. And so that pushed me even deeper into the TMS area. And at this point when I started practicing, and I never really had any serious chronic pain problem. So it wasn't really my own chronic pain that led me into this field, but more of a holistic foundation with a spiritual experience on top of it. And I think it's caused me to have a unique perspective, because I don't just do mind body, I do mind body spirit, which frames things a little differently in my mind. And some people find that really helpful.
It's logical what you were saying earlier about parallels with checking out Dr. Sarno's book and then what it is that you believe, or the experiences that you've had as a practitioner. And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not positive on what the definition of neurologist is, but when I think of neurologist, I think of nervous system. And I don't recall if Sarno uses the terminology of nervous system in any of his books. He probably does, but they do seem like they're certainly parallel. However, like during my quest, yeah, I went to neurologists, and that concept or that idea that was more Sarno-esque looking back was never really brought up. What's kind of your, because to me now, because I've been so entrenched in this for so many years, having somebody's nervous system just sort of wig out all of a sudden seems like it seems like it happens a lot more frequently than most people would even know, unless, you know, I'm looking around for it all the time. So I see it now all the time. Like what's up with that? How come do you think it's maybe not talked about more, or known about more, or discussed more, if, you know, your perspective as a doctor?
So to just be clear that I understand, you're saying with all the neurologists you've gone to, none of them seem to be aware of Sarno's perspective.
Yep. Yeah. It seemed to always kind of be, you know, oh, we got to investigate this. We got to do this. We got to do more imaging. And I was kind of already, you know, I'm 20 grand deep in imaging and treatments. And I feel like if it would have been found by now, why? And that's just me, you know, almost like jaded looking back, but you would probably be able to give some good perspective to that.
Yeah, I think that for each individual doctor, there can be different reasons. One of the main ones is that I think a lot of them haven't been exposed to this concept, and they just don't know about it. That's number one. Number two, it's a threat to some doctors. Some doctors really identify with and are financially dependent on the conventional way of treatment, and even though there's no real threat to that anytime soon, because I'll tell you, you can go out and tell a million people this stuff and they're still going to want to, there's still going to be a lot who don't follow it and want to take pills and have surgeries and all that stuff. But anyway, it can be seen as a threat. And so some doctors, I think even if they were aware of it, they wouldn't bring it forward, or maybe even they just their mind wouldn't let them accept it as a reality for, and it may not even be for monetary reasons. It just could be, you know, it's our individual life experiences that allow us to be more open to the idea the mind and body are connected. And some people have those experiences already and they're like, this makes total sense. And other people just don't. And they're just like, they can't see it. And it just seems like a bunch of mumbo jumbo. And And I would say in medicine, to kind of take that a step further, we're in conventional medicine, when I was trained, there was kind of like structural disease, so like real medical problems, you know, and then there was what we would call functional disease or factitious stuff, you know, or people who have hysteria or made up problems, you know what I mean? And so the second you go to accept this, if you accept that the problem's not structural, then you basically have to say the patient's kind of crazy, yeah, right? That's how it is in medicine. And, yeah, and the problem is there's a lot of chronic pain people that you would never be able to call crazy. A doctor knows they're highly functioning people who got jobs, and they, you know, they can tell they don't want pain meds. And so it leaves you in this quandary, like you can't, what box do you put them in if those are the only two you have? Whereas TMS nicely gives you this third option in the middle where you're not crazy and it's not structural, yeah, but it still is related to the actions of the mind and the emotions.
What, this is probably gonna be a really hard question to answer. And if it is, if it's too obscure, let me know. But by the time, so I'm sure this is probably how it works in every state. In my state, I'm in Washington. In order to even get to a neurologist, you would probably have to go see a general practitioner. They would get you a referral to like an orthopedic doctor or something like that. That person could then maybe write you a referral after you go and see them, could write you a referral to then maybe go see a neurologist. Like it's kind of, you're usually, you know, if I were to go see a neurologist, in my experience, it was two or three or four layers deep of referrals. That's just been my experience. And so is there, just as a practicing neurologist, is there like a particular problem or, you know, if you get 10 patients that come and see you in a day or a week or whatever the case may be, what's the highest percentage of people coming with? Is it a back problem or is it a neck problem or is it something else? Like what's kind of a, you know, what's maybe the highest percentage thing that somebody would come to see you about?
When I had an outpatient practice, which I don't do anymore, headache was by far and away the most common. And I bet you it still is to this day. So migraine and headache and back pain is a condition that there's overlap. So like you said, you could go to an orthopedic spine guy or a neurosurgeon, which is different than a neurologist, or you can go to a physiatrist, which is what Dr. Sarno was, you know, PM&R. And so I think when you have back pain, it depends on the region and what the neurologists like to do and how accessible they are, whether you'll end up going there. It's reasonable that you never see a neurologist for back pain. You go from your doc to a physiatrist, and when conservative treatments don't work, then they send you to a spine surgeon.
And that's a scary leap, that last one. I've interviewed Dr. David Hanscom a couple times, and he actually got out of doing surgeries entirely, based on kind of all the years and the things that he had found. He didn't say this, but my perspective listening to him talk is kind of like, surgeons like to do surgery. Like that's kind of the thing, like surgeons do surgery. And that's just
not fully. I mean, in the community I've worked in for like 15 years, the neurosurgeon who just retired, but who practiced there for the longest actually didn't like to do surgeries and people didn't like it.
Yeah.
He knew that you never knew if it was going to work or not. So he would try to have them do everything he possibly could before doing surgery.
Good for him.
So that might be true of some surgeons, but it's not a blanket statement that I could make. I know a lot of surgeons there's some who are more conservative and some who aren't.
Yeah. And again, it was just my perspective. I met with him at the Washington State Athletic Club, which is kind of like a bougie country club kind of in downtown Seattle. And that's where we did our in-person interview. And so that was a lot of fun to go and do that. But one thing that I went and did before I actually met with him was I went and looked at like vitals.com and healthreviews.com and things like that of him. And there was this contingent of a lot of people that would write reviews and they would have this beef with him where they would say, hey, I went to him because I wanted to get a surgery. And he suggested this book and these other things and kind of all this stuff that wasn't surgery. Like that was one thing that I read right before I went in to meet with him. And I thought, God, this is really interesting. Like, you know, that there's a lot of anger in these written reviews about him. And I kind of felt for him at that point in time.
I think all of us TMS believers know that whole experience to varying degrees.
Now, knowing what you know now, you know, and going through practice and kind of seeing the things that you've seen from like a mind-body perspective, mind-body-spirit perspective, you had said like headaches are kind of the overwhelming issue, or that might be the highest percentage if you had 10 patients that came and saw you. What's a like, misconception's not the right word. Let's say you have people come and see you. They've got a headache issue. You work with them. You deem it in your professional opinion to be, this is like mind, body, spirit origin. But if it were, if what's the typical reason maybe that they think that all of these things are causing it? Like what, how would a neurologist be trained where, hey, a lot of headaches or most of the time chronic headaches or migraines are caused by this, if it's not mind, body, spirit? Like where's the misconception maybe for some people? Does that make sense?
Are you saying what a doctors think or what a patients think?
Yeah, no, more so what doctors would think, or maybe where's the assumption wrong in the medical field that, hey, like it really is a mind, body issue, even though we've sort of thought for a long time that it's this other thing that's causing their problem.
I mean, the most common headache diagnosis would be tension and migraine would be my guess.
Okay.
I mean, in my clinic. And both of them are headache syndromes, which means they don't show up on any test. You diagnose it based on a spectrum of symptoms, a constellation of symptoms, and it behaves as a certain behavior, you know, and you kind of rule it out by looking for other things. And so I think the question I can't answer exactly is what do other neurologists think really causes those things? I mean, I would say most neurologists would say stress plays a big role in both of those.
Yeah.
I mean, tension really is like a muscular headache. And I bet you most neurologists would say, yeah, stress is probably somehow involved, but they don't know exactly how. And then the same thing with migraines. I think everybody recognizes that's a major factor, but my guess is they would think though that's not like the complete root cause. They would think, well, there's probably a genetic component because their mom and their grandma had them or there's food triggers and there's weather triggers and it could be the sinuses and all these different things. Medicines can trigger it. And I think in most neurologists' mind, they don't even need one root cause for these headaches. They just accept this really complicated explanation that there's just a whole bunch of different things and it supports a very complicated way of trying to treat it too.
Yeah. Yeah. How long have you been practicing? I didn't see.
So 2005, I finished my neurology training.
Okay. So close to 20 years, basically.
Yeah.
A couple decades.
Yeah, you're right.
So yeah, congratulations, by the way.
Yeah, thanks.
That sounds like a lot of school. So how, just your perspective as a, you know, somebody that's in the medical field, because again, it's one of those things where I only notice it that it's kind of out there in the collective conscious because now I'm looking for it. But how has the opinion of, we can say stress illness or we can say mind body or whatever the case is, like something that falls into that realm, how has that evolved since the mid 2000s? And I'll give you an example. Like it was maybe 4 years ago, the Seahawks were playing a football game. I can't remember if it was a playoff game or not. And I remember I saw a commercial for, I think it was Aetna, might've been Cigna, but this health insurance company was talking about mental health or emotional health leading to physical problems. And I was like blown away that this was appearing on a national, you know, I can't remember if it was Fox or CBS, but like a national broadcast. And I remember, because I'd been doing the podcast for 2 or 2.5 years by that point. And I was just shocked that this was like on TV. But again, it's because I'm looking for it too. So how much has this thought in the medical field, but also of your patients, maybe that you talk to, that you share this theory with, and they go, oh yeah, well that makes sense. Has that stuff evolved in the last 18, you know, 17 or 18 years from your observation?
I think so. I mean, there's my perception and my experience is it has been that people are more receptive. And part of that is because it's more accepted. Part of it is, I'd like to believe, because I, number one, am better recognizing the people who are open. Like I'm better gauging people and how far to go down the explanation path.
Yeah.
And I've kind of found a better way of delivering it. And it's not just about the way you describe it, but kind of like the energy you take and the being like a good listener, I guess you can say, as you talk. So there's a variety of factors that for sure I don't get rejected as much as I used to, and I don't have these like painful experiences related to it. I mean, actually I rarely do. And I would like to think part of that is because of me.
Yeah.
And I'm not in the clinic as much. Like the clinic is where people generally come in the past for short, you know, they're expecting quick fixes. But I think even in the clinic now, things have changed and I've seen more and more. Like I remember like maybe it was 2008. I had a patient come back from the Mayo Clinic, which probably most people know, it's kind of like, you know, one of the nationwide centers for health. And they came back and they're like, my neurologist, right? And they were diagnosed with a serious neurological disease, something like multiple sclerosis. And yeah, they said, the neurologist said I should be meditating. And she had this big like book on meditation and stuff. And I remember thinking like, well, that is cool. Because I was meditating at that point a little. And I was thinking that is cool. They're recommending that. But and I was like, they have some courage because not a lot of docs were doing that. And it gave me a little bit more courage to do it in my own practice. Now it's like not unusual to see doctors recommend meditation or mindfulness or yoga. Like when I started, you would be kind of an outlier and you'd be at risk of receiving some ridicule from your colleagues. I think right now it would be rare that you would.
Yeah.
And so I think there has definitely been partly is to explain for that is more and more people have been through the goose chase in conventional medicine. Call it the goose chase, where they're going from doc to doc and they're like, oh, it's that guy can help you. And then they're like, oh, this med will help you. And they finally get to the dead end, or their loved one's been through the goose chase. And so more people have this firsthand experience of the limits of modern medicine. And then they're starting to open up into these. And there's like nurses and doctors who are seeing it like I did, like, hey, I don't really know what's going on. And so I think it's these firsthand experiences that are helping people to open up. And I still feel like the concept of suppressed emotions or having unconscious emotions is not very well known. And that understanding that you can be full of stress without knowing it, I think that's an important key in the TMS field that helps people, because there's a lot of times where people have chronic stress, but nothing really particularly happened over the months leading up to their illness.
Yeah.
Or they have childhood stressors, or they just, you know, they don't recognize any stress in their life. And this is where, you know, unconscious emotions helps you to fill in that gap.
Is there any, and again, this is another obscure question, then I'll get into one that maybe you can answer a little bit easier, but you've done a phenomenal job on the ones that I say think that they could be hard, and you tend to explain them very well. But of the people that you get that have these TMS type issues and you're diagnosing it as such, how many of these fall into a camp of more so, and there's probably a little bit of all these ingredients in everybody's, you know, pot of soup, but people where it's mostly like childhood trauma type issues, or people that fall more into the camp of kind of, there's just a lot of stuff in life all the time, you know, the kids and the car payments and all that kind of stuff. Do you lean one way or the other on, in terms of, again, the example, if you have 10 patients that have TMS type symptoms, you know, chronic symptoms of whatever that you've determined are of mind, body, spirit origin.
Yeah.
How many of those are falling into a camp of where something happened 30 years ago, they haven't resolved that, and now it's really kicking their butt, or people that are more so or bigger contributor is something that's going on more current than that?
I would say, the way you divided it, I would say less people, and I might not be seeing, first caveat, I might not be seeing like a real clean representation of all TMS people, because yeah, I'm seeing people who find me for whatever reason, maybe they, you know, but I would say of the ones I'm seeing, less of them have like a major childhood trauma. I mean, I can think of a lot that do, but I'm thinking it's more like 30% if I had to just guess.
Has that tended to evolve over the years? Because, you know, with, we've had a kind of a bad last 3.5 years on this planet. And so do you notice that more in the, like, let's say the last 10 years, as opposed to the prior, you know, 5 years or 7 years or whatever? Like, is that something where you're seeing that paradigm shift a little bit more, where it seems like more people are having way more daily type life stress that's going on?
People are having more stress over the last few years. I'm not sure if I'm detecting it in the folks I help. Sure. I think for whatever reason, like, the amount that have like really intense childhood traumas, for, you know what I think happens with a lot of them is they don't come to the specialist because they know that is causing a lot of their issues. Yeah. They know they got this crap, and people with, they don't need to go all the way down to me as much to get somebody to say, yeah, your childhood traumas are a problem and we need to work on them. So I'm getting, I think there's a self-selection where I'm getting these people who just can't figure it out, and they just have doubts that it's emotional. So even though I do see people with, I tend to attract people who are on the, they want to believe it's TMS, but they're not sure, and they're kind of on the cusp. And so I would say more of the patients I get are getting in that group, and it may not be a representation of the population at a whole.
Yeah. Okay. Before we started rolling, I had said, hey, this is the beauty of running, of doing a podcast on this topic, is that I can ask the questions that I want. And I told you that it's been slim pickings on trying to find a neurologist. And in Sarna's literature, you can find a ton about MRIs. You can find a ton about x-rays. The thing that I don't see a lot about is in EMG tests. And I would love to just, you know, break it down as a neurologist. How can this TMSC stuff impact an EMG test, and kind of tell me about why a false, because with MRIs, for instance, Sarno just says that basically, like, you could have herniated discs and bulging discs, that there is a correlation in terms of age, where, like, it's gray hair of the spine was the term that he used. You know, you could have people that have severe back pain and nothing on their imaging, and people that have no back pain and have an awful MRI of their spine. And so for him, there's kind of no rhyme or reason between the two a lot of the time, especially if the physical exam doesn't match what the location of the site is. But as far as EMG tests, like, talk about that, because I know I got one in 2017, and when they rolled that machine in, it looked like it was medieval. The technology just looked really old. That was the first thing that jumped out to me. But talk
it
a little
is
medieval. Bit. Of, yeah, right, exactly. And they got all these needles, and they're just jamming you with needles all over the place. Tell me a little bit about that, like the EMG, and where its false positives could pop up, and why that would occur, and what people may be experiencing in a TMS angle.
I think there's two kind of aspects to answer this. I would say an EMG is somewhere about as useful as an MRI in determining if the patient's spine is pinching the nerves. Okay, because you can see on an MRI if there is, narrowing around the nerves as they exit the spine. And you can see on an EMG, if assuming it's a good practitioner who's really good at sorting out all the different abnormalities, because findings on an EMG could be from the spine or from the peripheral nervous system. And they could look a little bit similar unless you're doing real thorough about it, you know, like a diabetic neuropathy could look a little bit like pinched nerve in the back if you weren't thorough and evaluated the patterns. But assuming you have a good specialist doing the test, I think it's about equally valuable in identifying a pinched nerve. Now, the question I think you had is, does that tell you whether the person has chronic pain or not, more likely?
Yeah.
That leads us into like this rabbit hole, and the answer is I don't know. Like, I really don't even know what the, like, I think a pinch, I recognize a pinched nerve in the spine can cause numbness and weakness and acute pain, but I can tell you it doesn't reliably cause chronic pain, because like Dr. Sarno says, you image a bunch of middle-aged people, you know, a bunch of them have spinal problems, including neuroforaminal narrowing. And if you probably, if you went out and EMG'd a bunch of people, you would also find a certain percent of them have findings, and they may have little or no symptoms. I know carpal tunnel syndrome is that way. They can find carpal tunnel in people who don't have any of the symptoms. So how meaningful are these results is a huge question that I can't answer. And Eddie, what I'll tell you, I mean, what a lot of people come to me, they want me to say for sure this is TMS or for sure it's structural, and basically no doctor can. But what I can help them, and what I do is, what I can do is say, how good of a fit are your symptoms and your exam findings with the EMG and MRI that you had? And some patients come in and their symptoms are totally different. And I say, they don't even connect at all. Yep. And then other people, sometimes they'll come in and I'll say, you know what the abnormalities on those imaging on your EMG are almost exactly what I would expect them to cause almost exactly the symptoms you're having. So it's like classic. But even then, I can still give those people a endorsement to go full head into mind-body work. And the reason is, short of a spinal cord syndrome, which most people aren't coming to TMS doctors because of they're paralyzed in the legs and they have incontinence, you know, if it's just sciatic pain or back pain, even if they have like a foot drop, and you look at meta-analysis, which is a type of research where they compare a whole bunch of studies and compare the people who got surgery for that, and we're even including foot drop, versus those patients who didn't have the surgery, the outcomes are the same.
Wow.
And the only thing different, at least in the last meta-analysis I looked at, the only thing different was that the people who got the surgery tended, if they were going to be pain-free, they tended to be pain-free sooner.
Wow.
But you still had a bunch of people who didn't have their pain resolved. And then if you looked at the foot drop, there's some people who get the surgery and it never gets better. And there's some people who gets better. And it's the same happens in the non-surgical group. So what I can tell these people is you have the choice to do what you want. Even if this is 100% structural and you don't believe a word of Dr. Sarno, based on the studies, if you don't mind the if you would rather not have the surgery and try to cope with the pain, you have total right to do that, you know. And yep. And unfortunately a lot of neurosurgeons out there who don't recognize these studies, and they'll try to scare their patients and say exactly the opposite. Oh, if you don't get a surgery, you'll be in a diaper and a wheelchair in a year. And there's no evidence to support that for the conditions that we just talked about.
Yep.
You know, spinal cord syndrome is a different story. If somebody has narrowing around their spinal cord, then surgery is indicated, you know?
Yeah. Well, this has been great. Is there anything that I'm missing that I haven't asked about? I promise that we'd be done prior to 4:30 as we're recording here, but anything in particular that maybe I haven't asked about that you want to make sure that gets talked about? And then also, where can people find you online?
Say that last few words again.
I had just said, where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you?
Oh, okay. Well, I'll give that one first. So my, cause that's the easier, one. My website is healthy-mind-body.com. Or hyphen between the three words, and it has like a painting of a flower field and a farm picture on the homepage, so you kind of recognize it. And then there's a contact form people can get a hold of me that way. And I think that I guess there's a couple messages that come to mind that I end up telling a lot of my clients who I work with. One, I want to reemphasize what we said earlier, that you don't have to have a major trauma in your life to be having stress build up. And so it can be sort of insidious where you feel like everything's going well, but you're in a chronic state of tension. Number two, I don't know the exact mechanism that suppressed motions cause the pain. I appreciated Dr. Sarno's attempt, and because I know most of us are so analytic, we want to be able to like visualize. And so he created this diagram where the brain sends signals and then they restrict blood flow. Oxygen deprivation causes pain in the body. And that may be true in some cases, but I don't think that explains it all. And I do recognize that as humans, there is a part of us that exists on energy level, and you don't need a body to have pain, because we know that because of phantom limb syndrome.
Yep.
And so can all be at the energy level. And I don't know if that helps people or not, but for me, I don't really need an explanation. I just need to know there's factors that can help you get better. Another message I would have for people is when you find yourself in this position, consider just having the goal of learning, focus on the journey more than the destination. So, and just maybe make it your goal. You'll have more success if you make it your goal to just learn the tools so that you can come in and out of painful conditions, as opposed to making it this goal that I'm never going to have pain. I'll be pain-free and I'm a perfect, you know, emotionally clean person, and I won't be happy till I'm there. You know what I mean? And some people, that's their goal, whether it's chosen or sort of unconscious chosen goal. And then they get frustrated every time life brings them like a challenge.
Yeah. Yep.
And there's no need for that. I mean, life is going to bring you challenges, and it's okay when you have pain. You just have to remember to step back, remember the tools you have that had gotten you out of it before, and be patient with yourself and loving towards yourself.
I love it.
And then, you know, with I like to add the spirit to the end, which we didn't have to say that in the interview, but like the mind, body, spirit. The reason I add that, how to say this. So pain and illness and suffering on a whole for humanity has a deeper purpose. And I have experienced in my own life, and I believe this is true for all of us, that it is actually helping to create a transformation inside that brings us to a better place energetically or spiritually. And it's actually like really important. Those are part of important hidden life lessons in our life. You could say my spiritual teacher used to have a saying that went something like this, that every illness was in fact an attempted spiritual cleanse, that if we didn't interfere with it, with death being the most ultimate and final cleanse where we're freed from our body. And the first time I read that, it kind of rattled me a little bit, because as a doctor, you think of illness in a different way. And you're taught to interfere with it.
Yeah, yep.
On a whole bunch of different levels. And so when I started embracing that in my own life, I found it to be very true. And I find that my clients or folks who come to me who embrace that, it really helps them, because you don't beat yourself up every time something happens. And I think one of the biggest tools to use just mentally to navigate through those illnesses is, you know, never wish pain on ourselves or problems, but when it's there and you can't do anything about it, you've tried all of the quick fixes for it, then take on the mindset that that you have chosen things to be the way they are. Like, even though nobody likes pain, see what happens when you choose this mindset that act as if you had chosen things to be the way they were. And you can hold that mindset while still trying to search for a solution. So I guess that would be another important thing, is I just remind people, when I've had a couple very intense illnesses that came up, and I embraced them as a cleanse, as something was good was going to happen, and very good things happened in my life after these. Some of them were months long odysseys of hell, essentially, you know.
There's a therapist in San Diego I've interviewed a couple of times on here that her big theme and kind of the whole underlying of her work is all around doing what you can to retain, to either retain or reclaim your power. And that's that to me, it sounds like you're kind of saying a really similar thing.
Yeah. So. Yeah. There's, you know, in life, what's most important is how you react to what happens, not what happens. And so if you always take on that mental approach, then you have power and you stay empowered and have control. And it's true. How you react is the most important thing. And I choose to be loving in all situations and towards all people as an inward approach to life.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I let people step on me. It doesn't mean I don't have boundaries and stuff, but it just means that my overall wish towards people is I wish them well.
Roger, thank you for being here. Hang on the line. I'm going to fake say goodbye right now for the end of the podcast, but hang on the line for 30 seconds afterwards. But hey, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.